Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 20 years ago, environmentalist Bill McKibben looked out on a world increasingly dominated by humans and wrote his first book, The End of Nature. A quick 2 decades later, he's got a bigger claim that Earth itself, as we've known it, is gone, eclipsed by climate change, and now we must learn to live, he says, on a reduced planet in a new way. It's a hard message for what he says we have irretrievably made, a harder planet. This hour on Point, Bill McKibben on our new planet, Earth. You can join the conversation, Can You Bear McKibben's View, that our planet is gone and we've put ourselves on a new one that demands a new way of living. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Bill McKibben joins me now in the studio. He's written more than a dozen books on the love of nature and its loss, among them The End of Nature, Wandering Home, Deep Economy. He's founder of the environmental group 350.org, an organization dedicated to taking on climate change. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont and author of the new book, Earth. That's Earth with 2 A's, Making Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill McKibben, welcome.
Hey, always good to be here, Tom.
Earth with 2 A's. Why?
Well, you know, when we set out that warning 20 years ago, me and other people, we didn't know how fast we were going to see really widespread change, how fast climate change was going to kick in. It kicked in faster, really, than almost anybody expected. And hence, the changes that we're seeing now are large enough to say that the Holocene has come to an end, that the planet we were born onto and that all of human civilization has known is now shifting and rapidly beneath our feet. Take just one example. We're all watching in horror right now as that slick of oil extends across the Gulf. Mm-hmm. But invisibly, an even more profoundly more dangerous slick of acid is spreading across all the Earth's oceans. As seawater struggles to absorb carbon from the atmosphere, its pH is dropping and dropping fast. The ocean is 30% more acid now because of the carbon we've poured into the atmosphere. Everything frozen on Earth is melting. The atmosphere holds 5% more moisture than it did 40 years ago because warm air holds more water vapor than cold. These are changes so profound that we have barely begun to grapple with them. And now we're going to have to, A, adapt to those changes, learn some new habits for a new planet, and B, we're going to have to work like hell to keep them from getting even worse, out of control. We're going to have to take on global warming in the way that we haven't in the last 20 years.
A new planet with a new name, Earth with 2 A's, from Bill McKibben. Let me quote you here just a little bit. You say, we've built a new Earth. It's not as nice as the old one. It's the greatest mistake humans have ever made, one that we will pay for literally forever. We live on a new planet, but we have to live in it, you say, so we'd better start understanding what the hell is going on. The fight is lost?
Well, everything's relative. We've lost the fight to stop global warming, to keep it from happening. Okay, the planet's warmed 1 degree. It's going to warm another degree from carbon we've already got in the atmosphere. So in that sense, we're living on a new Earth, this Earth with 2 A's. But we could go to an Earth with 4 or 5 A's. The climatologists tell us that there's very little doubt that unless we quickly get off fossil fuel, we're going to see temperature increases of 5, 6, 7 degrees this century. That'll take what's going to be a miserably difficult situation and turn it into a science fiction one, one that we just can't even begin to deal with.
I'm trying to get my mind around just what you're saying here. I mean, you say that we've been through a period of 10,000 years where the Earth changed relatively little, and that in that 10,000 years, human civilization was built. It was built around a particular Earth, a particular planet that's gone. What does that mean for who we are, how we define ourselves, for the civilization you're pointing
to? Well, think just about the physical parts of that civilization. In the stability of the Holocene,
The Holocene.
That's the last 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. We've built, all our great cities, or many of them, right on the coast. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a great idea at the time.
Beautiful views. That's close to the sea.
But if the ocean rises, as it's already rising, 5, 6, 7 feet, those locations are going to seem a lot less grand than they did. Already we're seeing places around the world that are sinking beneath the waves, and that's going to continue as the century goes on.
You say we'll need to figure out what parts of our lives and our ideologies we must abandon so that we can protect the core of our societies and civilizations.
The habit that we're going to have to get rid of first, the thing that we're going to have to finally grapple with, is this idea that growth will solve every problem that we face. 40 years ago in this city, people put out that famous booklet, The Limits to Growth, and they've been scorned and poo-pooed and scoffed at ever since, but they were right. We're running into those limits. When you melt the Arctic, that's a bad sign, okay? We're going to have to figure out a whole new set of habits, and they're going to have to do with resilience and stability and security. We're going to have to stop fixating on that growth, because it's growth we can no longer afford.
So we've lived in a sweet spot over, as you would call those 10,000 years, and we kind of wrecked it ourselves by your reckoning anyway. You say Earth, that's your new Earth with two A's, represents the deepest of human failures. Do we stay human in this new? Is it just that we just have to stop being such avid consumers? Are we at core the same, or is there something else that emerges here?
What we have to get away from, I think, is what we've done for the last little while. The hyper-individualism that marked the high consumer era we've been living through, that's been driving an awful lot of our trouble. I mean, think about what it means in terms of, say, fossil fuel use, that we all have to go every place we go in our own cars by ourselves. That's an American idea, and it's an American idea that now informs the temperature of the planet.
But just for starters, I mean, hyper-individualism, some people will hear that as a way of saying Americanism.
A kind of
almost in the Constitution.
No, I think not.
Individual liberty.
I don't think there's any danger that we're going to get away from individualism in this country. It seems pretty firmly ingrained.
Yes, it does.
What we need to get away from is the kind of extreme expression of it that's marked the last 40 years. Look what our economy has been about. Its main function since the end of World War II has been building bigger houses farther apart from each other. That's contributed not only to this ecological catastrophe, it's also contributed to the social one that we face. Americans are considerably less happy with their lives than they were 50 years ago, all the surveys indicate, because we've lost that connection. The one possible silver lining to what is a very dark environmental cloud is that in dealing with this problem, we're going to have to recover some of that community and connection. You can see it starting to happen. You know, the fastest growing part of our food economy right now is local farmers markets. That's the kind of built down approach to the world we're going to need to take. We've just come through this period when we've learned that our economic system, our financial institutions, had gotten too big to fail. Well, it's not just our financial institutions. Our energy system, our agriculture system, they're at least as top-heavy and at least as primed for that same kind of catastrophic problem.
I want to circle back to the economic implications of what you're saying and the social implications, but I think for some people, maybe we should just go back to the top one more time here, because you're saying the planet our sort of civilization grew up on is gone. Make the case for that once more. Physically,
stop.
What are you saying is gone? Where are we? What's gone? And
where are
we physically?
So stop thinking. I mean, the key to this is to stop thinking about global warming as something that's going to happen to your grandkids. Okay, that's how even 20 years ago we really were thinking about it. We didn't understand just how finely balanced the planet was. It turns out that the amount of carbon we've already put in the atmosphere and the extra amount of heat it traps, about 2 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface, has been enough to kick off really profound changes. If you want to date the sort of real recognition of that, the summer of 2007 would be a good place to start. That was the extremely rapid melt of the Arctic. I spent that summer getting phone calls from scientists that I'd known for a quarter century who'd always been worried and sober and concerned, and now they were panicked. They were saying, Tom, look, this is happening feature after feature of the planet faster than we expected.
And
really
soon you had ships sailing through the there where they'd never sailed, and the ship captain saying not a cube of ice to be seen.
That's it. And soon we were having, you know, in Bolivia, the highest glacier in the country literally disappearing, completely melted. Soon we were having people study seawater. No one had ever expected that the chemistry of the ocean could actually change. The oceans are our metaphor for vastness, you know. When they looked at what was going on and found that abrupt increase in acidity, that terrified the oceanographers.
And the planet we live on now, then, compared to the one we have sadly left behind?
Well, it's in a state now of violent flux. The best thing about the one that we had for the last 10,000 years was its benign stability. In some ways, the worst thing about the current one is its unpredictability. To give one example, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, we're getting, in places that are moist anyway, wicked increases in downpour, in deluge, in flood. Ask your average civil engineer, that 100-year flood, that 100-year storm that they plan for, suddenly it's showing up every 3 or 4 years. I mean, look what happened 3 weeks ago in Rhode Island, the worst, the highest rainfall they'd ever seen and the worst flooding. The week after that, it was Rio de Janeiro. You know, thousands die as hillsides disappear under the largest rainstorms they've ever seen, everywhere around the globe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with environmentalist Bill McKibben about the planet he says is already gone, ours, and how to live on what we've got now. He calls it Earth with two A's. His new book is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill McKibben joins me in the studio. There's a lot more to look at here. Let's hear from our listeners as well. Palm Desert, California. Jeff, you're on the air with Bill McKibben.
Hi. I was just kind of thinking that we used to kind of be like one with the earth, like from the ancient days and stuff, and we kind of like got disconnected. We think it's separate from us. So like everything we do to the earth, we're kind of doing to ourselves. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Bill?
Well, the point is a good one. We've allowed ourselves in recent times to become extremely disconnected from the earth, you know. What's the modern suburb but a device to hide the processes of the planet from us, you know, to make it the same temperature every place we go and nice and smooth and you don't even know where the rivers are, you know. We're going to be back immersed in the planet more and more and more because those processes that we're amping up, we're not going to be able to escape. The results are going to be around us all the time. The little town where I live in Vermont, you know, small town at the top of a hill, we had the summer of 2008, the two worst rainstorms ever recorded, about 6 weeks apart. Now, our town's almost 100% intact forest. It's all national forest. If any place should have been able to absorb rainfall, it's us. But this wasn't rainfall of the kind that used to fall on our planet. It was way more. And as a result, our little town almost washed away. I mean, the governor had to come visit on a helicopter. We were cut off from the rest of the world for days. Not only was that unsettling, to build the road back up to the 500 of us who live at the top of the mountain is going to take about $2 million. Multiply that by an endless number of these things, and you begin to understand that if we ever lived on a kind of Friedman flat earth, we don't anymore. It's increasingly an uphill planet with a lot of drag and a lot of friction, including economic friction.
A tough, hotter, harder planet. I mean, you said examples from all over in Bangladesh where the rising sea has put salt in the drinking water. You've got reports here from newspapers in Dhaka saying, you know, families struggling to get water. Their adolescent daughters, their teenage daughters, they marry young there. They can't find husbands because that salty water makes their skin unattracted to people from outside. You look at Santa Barbara, where you've got in California with this record number of lightning strikes in one recent year. 1,700 different fires across California in just one day in June 08, lightning sparking, 1 million acres on fire, new state record up in those Santa Barbara hills.
you go up the Arctic, there's places where there had never been thunder or lightning before. I mean, literally no words in the vocabulary for them, and now they're becoming commonplace. You know, every part of the world that we can look at is changing very, very fast. Now, we can still limit that damage. We can keep it from getting worse than it has to get. That's what I spend most of my life doing at 350.org. But that begins with a kind of recognition that we're in trouble now, not that we're going to be in trouble sometime in the future, which is how everybody, including our president, has tended to talk about climate change.
It's here. It's costly. I mean, our whole physical way of life was built to the planet that Bill McKibben says was, not necessarily what is. Lawrence, Massachusetts. Tennis, you're on the air, Tennis.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. McKibben, I've been an environmentalist most of my adult life, and I'm a huge fan of your work. It's an honor to be able to talk to you. I serve on my local conservation commission, and in urban areas like Lawrence, stormwater management is the biggest issue that we have to deal with. And just to give people an idea of the practical things that we have to deal with because of climate change, here in Massachusetts, in the northeastern U.S., we see an increase now in the amount of precipitation that's dropped on major storm events, so much so that the old rainfall standards that people use when they're doing stormwater calculations for permitting aren't valid anymore. You're getting 20 to 30% more rainfall in a moderate to heavy storm event, and the old stormwater structures that people put in place in the 70s and 80s are constantly being overtaxed. They're not sufficient. So we've had to change the way we permit projects and require more storage, more treatment, larger pipes to handle stormwater. And it's more expensive and more time-consuming. But we've seen it, and this is just in the past 30 or 40 years. We've seen this increase, and if the general circulation models are even close to accurate, it's going to get much worse here in the Northeast.
And there's just one town, one community with that.
Absolutely. Now, think about what the implications of that are in a larger sense, okay? One of the best human technologies there ever was the actuarial table, the ability of humans to hedge risk by understanding what was coming. The problem with an actuarial table, the problem with the insurance industry that's at the basis of much of our dynamic economy, is that it's built on the idea that the world will behave in the future more or less as it has behaved
absolutely
in the past.
Absolutely built on that, certainly.
You take that out, and it becomes, among other things, almost impossible to price risk.
Which that's the insurance companies are freaked out about.
There's large parts around the Gulf Coast, for instance, where you already can't really buy homeowners insurance, or you're turning to the state as an insurer of last resort because nobody knows how to make the calculations in an age when storms are suddenly stronger than they were before.
So there's a story from Lawrence, Massachusetts, about dealing with rainwater. But look on around the planet with us, Bill, at the adaptations that are already having to be made and what's coming in just those terms, never mind economic, social.
Well, think about, say, you're working in public health, all right? What you should be doing if you're in the developing world and what people have been trying hard to do is work on family planning, work on AIDS prevention, work on obesity prevention, work on all the things that need to happen. Instead, what you're doing across the developing world now is dealing with emergency cases of people with mosquito-borne disease. Dengue fever is up 200% in the last decade across Asia and South America. The cost of that, dealing with that, means that you can't do the kind of development work that you should be doing. You know, we're beginning to see the monsoons become unreliable in Asia. India had the worst monsoon year in many years last year. Combined with increased heat, that kind of drought is incredible economic drag. It means that you can't do the kind of development work you'd otherwise be doing.
The sweetest spots we've been in, you say we've lost. In all those 10,000 years, temperature barely budged. Globally average has been swung in a narrow range between 58 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Warm enough that ice sheets retreated from the center of the continent. You could grow grain. Cold enough that mountain glaciers provided drinking and irrigation water to those plains and valleys year-round. It was sort of the climate for us, the species that evolved.
Almost by definition, because we evolved to deal with that climate. It's not that we couldn't perhaps deal with a different climate, although if it gets much hotter, that'll be very hard. But it's that we're the cost of having to shift our arrangements from the one we spent 10,000 years building to the planet we're now on will be enormous. That's the reason that we're going to have to get past growth and on to some other more bottom-line calculations about how we're going to persist.
We'll talk about that. Let's get to your home turf, Montpelier, Vermont. Christopher, you're on the air with Bill McKibben.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, I'm a diesel mechanic and aircraft mechanic for many years now, and there is evidence in several scientific books that I've read that there's just a natural global climate change throughout Earth's history. Now, would this be an accumulation of both our pollution and a global shift with near the sun, or would it be one way or the other, or which would have more of an effect?
That's a very good question. That was the one that we were trying to solve 20 years ago when I wrote The End of Nature. And by the mid-1990s, scientists had reached a robust consensus that this was human-caused, anthropogenic, this warming that we're seeing. If anything, the planet should be slightly cooling over a very long period of time now. The way to think about it and the way to understand why it's not a shock is to think about what we're doing. We're taking hundreds of millions of years worth of biology, all those ferns and plankton and dinosaurs that turned into coal and gas and oil, and in the space of a couple of hundred years, pushing it all out into the atmosphere. It would be a shock if it wasn't causing huge changes.
And so it is Jennifer in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Jennifer.
Yes. My question is, your message of reducing consumption, I'm totally on board with you, but it conflicts so intensely with all the messages that we've been getting in the past couple of years from policymakers, from the president, from everybody about how to improve our economic situation, decrease joblessness, and sort of how you resolve that conflict.
Well, I'm glad you went to that. That is huge. It's right in the heart of this. You know, Bill, you've seen, thank you, Jennifer, the headlines this morning, people celebrating because of 3.2% GDP growth. It was not as much as they wanted. Everyone's longing for that to get jobs back. You quote in your book, you quote Larry Summers, who's now at the right hand of President Obama on economics, when he was Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, saying, "We cannot and will not accept any speed limit on American economic growth. It is the task of economic policy to grow the economy as rapidly, sustainably, and inclusively as possible."
That's, in a sense, the problem, and Jennifer crystallizes it perfectly. In the economy that we have at the moment, anything but growth causes misery. The pain of the recession is obviously very real. That's why on a finite planet, we have to figure out how we're going to have an economy that manages to be both stable and humane. It shouldn't be impossible. Our populations are now beginning to stabilize around the world in terms of size. What we need to get away from, though, is the idea that we forever are going to have to require more. That's why I think the key first step is putting a stiff price on carbon. Fossil fuel, its cheapness and its endless availability has been the thing that's driven modernity. Until we're able to put a stiff price on it, we won't be able to even begin to break that addiction. When we do, then the trends that we're beginning in isolated small cases to see, like, say, the move to local agriculture, will really surge already. And here's a piece of good news, since I've not been giving you much. In the last agricultural census in this country, the number of farms in America for the first time in 150 years is increasing, not decreasing. Mostly people growing food essentially for their neighbors to eat, that farmer's market demand finally starting to kick in. We need to take those kind of examples. We need to take not just with agriculture, but with energy itself. We need to build a grid whose hallmark is not endlessly more cheap power, but spread out, distributed, resilient power. We need a grid that looks like a farmer's market in electrons, where there are people with solar panels in every suburb supplying each other with the juice that they need.
We'll talk about the politics of how that might or might not happen. It hasn't happened nearly to the extent of your vision yet, but I think an awful lot of Americans really have trouble even imagining this. I'm not sure I can fully imagine it myself. You see, the population is stabilizing, but it is an enormous population on this planet. You know the size of the cities. Just look at American cities. We're the most affluent, therefore with the most resources to put toward this or to subtract and still be not hungry. I mean, paint the picture of what your no or slow growth would really look like, and how does it take, so how do you get from Los Angeles?
Let's get partway there.
Those freeways to your picture.
Let's get partway there without panicking, okay? Probably a lot of listeners have been in recent years to, say, Western Europe. I mean, the average Western European lives a life that's worth living, yes? It's not
certainly
in a cave. The average Western European uses half as much energy as the average American.
Is that good enough for you,
though? No, it's not good enough at all, but it's a reasonable start, and it demonstrates that without new technology, simply by changing your social arrangements, you can begin to make real progress. The difference between us and Western Europe is that they've chosen slightly differently on this spectrum that runs from hyper-individualism at one end to community at the other. They put a stiff price on fossil fuel at the end of World War II. As a result, they never sprawled out the way that we did in this country. They built good train networks. They have a decent, better than decent way of life.
But that's only
at
a halfway
start.
Yeah, it's a piece. But I mean, when I read yours, I picture sort of, I don't know, little villages in the woods and grass huts.
No, don't. I wouldn't picture that at all. I mean, there are lots of possibilities.
I don't mean that disparagingly.
We're seeing great work done on urban agriculture, say, all over the world with people learning how to support. I mean, there's plenty of really interesting things that have happened in the last 20 years. We've learned how to do very intensive farming, and now we understand that around the world, almost crop for crop, the most productive farms we have are the smallest ones. There are plenty of ways to do sustainable agriculture with high yields without relying on petroleum, with relying on people instead.
But growth is the way that we've understood to employ people, to increase what we've called the standard of living. Maybe you want that to go down. I'm not sure. You say the kind of words we should be thinking about now are not flashy words about growth, but words like durable, sturdy, stable, hardy, robust. You're right. These are squat, solid, stout words that conjure a world where we no longer grow by leaps and bounds, but where we hunker down, where we dig in. Is that life on your new planet?
Well, I think that's life on the planet that we're coming at. And I don't hold any brief for them exactly. I'm saying this is what we're going to have to do if we want to persist on a much more difficult planet. Tom, we're talking about raising the temperature, if we don't get things under control, 5, 6, 7 degrees. We're talking, therefore, as the scientists are beginning to tell us, about shortfalls in grain yields of 20, 30, 40%. We're talking about complete chaos as people begin to try to move and migrate to escape rising sea waters to find places to grow food. The Pentagon has become very clear that this is the greatest threat we face this century. On and on and on. We're out of options. Now we're going to have to figure out how to deal as elegantly as we can with a very, very difficult situation.
Boy, it looks tough. I mean, the politics of making this transition, I'm having trouble bringing on board. Look at already. People talk about a tax on carbon and absolute uproar.
Look at the incredibly weak global warming bill that John Kerry and others have been trying to introduce. They still haven't even managed to introduce it to the Senate. Mm-hmm. But even if they do, it's so loaded with compromise, among other things. It foresees a huge increase in offshore oil drilling, something that's a little harder to contemplate this week. We haven't gotten serious, but we can. The movement that we've been building at 350.org is optimistic, and we can talk about the spread of that sentiment around the world now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with environmentalist Bill McKibben about the planet he says is already gone, ours, and how to live on what we've got now. He calls it Earth, with two A's to distinguish it from the 10,000-year sweet spot, he says, in which human civilization grew up. His new book is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, Bill.
Hi.
I live in Cambridge, and I'm kind of concerned about the behavior of Cantabrigians, who are, for the most part, very convinced of global warming. But, for example, you know, the amount of e-waste that is being produced here, I mean, I saw a figure on 60 Minutes on television that 130,000 computers are thrown out a day. And just a couple of weeks ago, for example, Tom mentioned that there are 28,000 trips to Europe in planes every single day.
Mm.
I mean, even the people who are convinced of global warming seem not to be willing to alter their behavior.
You still want to fly to California and see your kids, or off to Europe for a vacation.
Or down to Cancun for an ecological weekend.
Yeah.
So let's, Bill.
Let's
talk about these two, actually, because I think in a subtle way they're very related. E-waste and jet travel.
By e-waste, you mean high-tech gizmos that we throw out when they're done.
So we're not going to be able to sustain the kind of taken-for-granted everywhere instant mobility by jet that we've gotten used to. That requires energy that we won't have and can't afford to be burning.
If the children or sister Sue moves to California, we don't see her anymore. She just doesn't move there.
So that, I don't know, one or the other. But that doesn't mean that we give up contact with the rest of the world. One of the few really good wild cards we have working for us right now is the arrival in our lives of this strange thing, the internet. It turns out you can make 1,000 Google searches for the amount of energy it takes to travel in a car 0.6 miles. We're going to have to learn how to travel by mouse, as it were, a good deal more.
You mean your spring vacation is looking at Cancun on the internet?
You know, your spring vacation might well be.
Family reunion is Skype?
Your spring vacation might well be in your own neck of the woods, you know. But for the first time, it's possible to imagine living a really local life, economic life, without having to shut yourself off from the rest of the world, without the parochialism that always marked and diminished small town.
Our town.
There's always now can be a window open on the rest of the world for new ideas to blow in and old ones to blow out. I know this for a fact because we managed to, working mostly on Skype and on the internet, assemble what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history last fall, 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries demanding action on climate change at 350.org.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't have done that even a few years before.
But I'm still trying to pull the curtain back on what you're really seeing, because I think you're soft-selling us a little bit compared to your book.
Mm.
I mean, Steve mentioned air travel. We put a little map up on the web showing global air travel. It's just like a dense, thick fur of daily planes flying. Are those going to be down? Are we not going to be flying around the world in your new hard planet?
I think we're probably not in those ways. And I'm sure we're not going to be shipping food back and forth by airplane. The fastest growing part of our air travel, in fact, is sending cut flowers and green beans.
No blueberries from Chile?
No. That's all right. That's why it's very good news that we've had this local food idea sort of beginning to percolate in this country, more than percolate now, really on the ascendant. Those are the sort of shifts that we're going to have to make. Now, I'm not telling you that they're all easy or wonderful or that we're not going to notice them. I'm just telling you that's the world we live in now. I mean, the choice is to keep doing exactly what we're doing for another 25 and 30 years and watch the temperature go so far through the roof that, if the planet's not hell, then the temperature is going to be remarkably similar.
Mark in Maynard, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air with Bill McKibben.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bill.
I have suburban
chickens and garden beds in my yard, and I work in sustainability, so I'm already on board, although I haven't read your book yet, Bill. But I feel as though our culture is in something of a stranglehold by corporations, banks, and even our government. Frankly, I'm profoundly disappointed with the Obama administration and their talk of return to growth and green shoots and the economy's back on track. because I really do feel that we need to downsize and look at a new way of living. And I guess my question, Bill, and I don't know if you've answered this or addressed it in your book, is how do we... I think people would respond if they could get the message, if it wasn't drowned out by media that doesn't address this. How do we break that stranglehold?
Well, that's a very good question. And, of course, it's one of the reasons that one writes books and things. Mm-hmm. But the most instrumental quick way to do it is precisely what I've been talking about, putting a serious price on fossil fuel. The reason that we expanded, sprawled, grew in the ways we did was that we had access to all that cheap energy. If we deny ourselves through the vehicle of price some of the access to that, then at the very least we'll start in the direction of Western Europe. You know, we'll begin the first steps down this road. Hopefully we'll figure out that they aren't so bad and accelerate. The point is, we're either going to do this voluntarily or it's going to be done for us by a natural world that is going to already is exacting an increasing human and economic cost for the changes that we've kicked off.
But you make a very tough point in here that I think will be hard for some people to swallow. You point to Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who's gone on a huge green kick in recent years. He writes about green all the time, about putting a price on carbon. Again and again and again he says it. And as you write, he insists that what we need to do is build a technologically advanced America, a shining green city on a hill. Once the full array, the big windmills strung across the Midwest, the concentrated solar arrays in the Arizona desert, that is a vision that Americans can, in the kind of old way, relate to. We get it. We're going to grow green. And you say no. You say the Friedman vision of this high-tech, green, go, green, that even that won't work.
I think it's too late to do it on that kind of scale, that the transition we're going to need is instead to a much more what the engineers would call distributed generation, to spreading out, to building down systems instead of just trying to pull the internal combustion engine out of the growth machine we've got and stick a wind turbine somehow in it. Instead, the logic of the fuels that we're going to rely on in the future, sun and wind, which are the opposite of fossil fuel. Fossil fuel is concentrated, rich in BTUs. It made sense to build big centralized economy around it. Sun and wind are omnipresent but diffuse.
But he's not just talking about technology. He's talking about a lifestyle.
Yeah,
lifestyle, but green.
Try to imagine, even in a sort of green form, a lifestyle anything like the one that we live at the moment applied across 9 billion people. It's not going to happen. We don't have atmosphere, resources, time to make it happen. We're already suffering the consequences of trying to make it happen as the temperature rises. It's time to pay some attention for once, not just to what we want, but to what's possible.
By the traditional, what we call the standard of living in this country, what's that going to be in your vision? Is it going to be reduced by 50%? I know you're going to say it's just different, but Americans are trying to maybe get their head around.
I think that it's hard to say what the end point of it all is. I mean, the important thing for the moment is the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Are we headed in ever long, headlong pursuit of more, or are we beginning to try to figure out what comes next? I don't know where we end up, but I know that it's that where we end up, the basic unit will be at least as much the community as the individual, the neighborhood, the block, the town, the village. Those are the units that we're going to have to start thinking about, because that's how we're going to make it through, persist in a tougher world.
Very interesting. Subtraction, you say, will be necessary. We always talk about the complexity of modern life. Complexity itself will be reduced, will be diminished in this tough new planet, you say.
Which is okay.
Well,
let's think about the financial system, which gave us a pretty good model for this in the last few years.
Okay.
It was growing all the time, but it was growing through a kind of insane, almost, complexity. We were doing things that even the bankers who were doing them didn't quite understand, and it turned out they were linked together in ways that caused the whole thing to totter. Well, the same kind of complexity across many of our systems. I mean, for food, pull out Citibank and AIG, substitute Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland. They're pursuing strategies, whether they're the endless application of more fossil fuel to more and more. They've created an agricultural system where soil is basically a matrix in which you hold plants upright while you pour oil over them.
But it's not just a corporate picture you're describing. You say, you know, most animals get up in the morning and simply start milling around looking for food. That is simplicity. You contrast that with what we've developed. We get up in the morning, we hear this, and hear the story goes far off from what a sloth or a groundhog would do. Some of us commute to offices or factories. Some people have jobs building and maintaining the cars we drive. Other people have jobs reading the news we listen to on the radio. Hey, that's my job.
Yes, you are.
As we navigate the freeway. That complexity, you write, is our glory, but also our vulnerability. People complain about that complexity, but they're also pretty addicted to it. We like
absolutely.
Our variegated lives.
Look, Tom, you keep arguing that that people like the world that we have now.
Well.
And indeed we do. I'm not arguing with you, although
there's a lot we don't like.
The statistics would indicate that Americans are much less happy with their lives now.
Yeah.
But at any rate, that's the wrong argument.
Mm.
I say over and over again in the book that this will be extremely difficult.
Yeah.
That's not the point. The point is that it'll be way more difficult to try and keep doing exactly what we're doing on a planet that no longer allows it to happen. It's time to drop the defensiveness a little bit and start trying to think about how we might deal with that world.
It's not so much a defense I'm looking to make here, just to make real the distance
Understood.
You're describing. It is,
and it's a very good point. Mm. It is a big distance. It's about as big as the distance between the world that we were born onto and the one where all of a sudden seawater is 30% more acid, where all of a sudden there's really not much ice left, where all of a sudden those storms have turned into something entirely different.
Get real, says Bill McKibben. Ralph in Baltimore. Ralph, you're on the air. Hello, Ralph. Are you there, my friend? All right, let's go to Mike in Harvard, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Yeah, everybody's running
they're thinking. It's,
let's
know.
Get to another. Brendan, Somerville, Massachusetts. Brendan, you're on. I don't know if our... Brendan, you there?
See what I meant about the complexity of modern systems?
We'll go to Norfolk, Virginia then. Adam in Norfolk. Are you there, Adam?
Hi, yes, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call.
You're on.
I had a couple of quick questions, I guess, I wanted to pose to you. Number one, I think that there is a large majority of people who want to take advantage of some of the technologies that we've created to be a little more environmentally friendly. I think some of these technologies, i.e. solar panels, they're just to a point where they're available to the mass public at an affordable rate that we can take advantage of these. And then in the second part would be, I think it's kind of a self-perpetuating problem that we have, because as the steps that we're taking to combat some of the things that we're seeing with we're building Priuses because we want to go to, you know, more eco-friendly cars. Well,
right.
How many factories are we building that are polluting the environment just as much as as the cars that we're driving now? And what kind of steps are we taking that you've seen? That not only the means, but the method of making these products is just as environmentally friendly as the means as the products themselves.
Thank you, Adam. Bill.
So this is a very good point. Nothing comes for free, you know? So the most promising technologies are the ones that really pay back for themselves pretty fast. Solar panels fall into that category. What really falls into that category, and you can put on the top of your roof, are these solar thermal hot water heaters.
Mm-hmm.
Those, I've been in cities in China. I describe them in the book. Cities of a couple of million people where 98% of people get their hot water from the sun on their roof. Those are the sort of relatively cheap, quickly paid back things that we need to now be doing en masse everywhere we can. They're much more resilient technologies than the ones we have now.
The simple ones, not the complex ones. I want to squeeze one more. James, Waltham, Massachusetts. James, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm listening to the discussion, and I realize I'm concerned that democracy itself may actually be something that is shooting us in the foot somewhat. I'll give an example. Who's going to vote for $10 a gallon gas? If we could take half of that and put it towards solar energy, that would probably be great. but, you know, politicians are powered by their constituencies, are, you know, beholden to them. And, you know, you look at a country like China, and they have the ability to put programs in place, kind of maybe even against the will of the general populace, but that might be good for the environment or for green technologies. And I'm concerned that democracy might actually be a liability for us.
James, we've got it. Our time's short. Bill?
If we want democracy to work, we're going to have to make it work. That's why I spend most of my time as a volunteer building these big political campaigns. The first global grassroots campaign about climate and carbon, 350.org. It's growing really rapidly. Foreign Policy magazine just wrote a piece describing our rally last October as the largest ever coordinated rally on any topic at any time in the planet's history. October 10th this year, 10-10-10, a global work party in thousands of places around the world, people putting up solar panels, digging community gardens, putting up bike lanes, not because we're going to solve global warming one bike path at a time. We're not. We need huge concrete action to change the price, but because we want to send a message to our leaders, if we can get to work, by God, you can get to work and see if you can make democracy deal with the biggest problem that it's ever faced.
We're going to have joy. We're going to have beauty in this new world. You say we will, but it won't be a nice new, fancy new pair of shoes from China.
It'll have to be some much deeper things than that. And though we've taken this world and damaged it, it remains a place of enormous beauty. You can see that today as that oil washes up on the Gulf. That Gulf is a gorgeous place. And remembering that, maybe, as we did in Santa Barbara 41 years ago, we'll find the power to really start changing.
The new book by Bill McKibben is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.